Some cases close with a confession, some close with a conviction, and some never really close at all. The Grimes Tapes is a detective fiction series following Detective Sarah Grimes as she works the cases that don't fit neatly into a file. Cases where power, politics, and human nature collide. And the truth is, the last thing anyone wants found. The Grimes Tapes, Season 2, Next of Kin, Episode 2, The Son. Nathan Brannick is missing. His father is dead. The evidence points one direction, and Grimes follows it, into an arrest and a crime scene that tells a different story than the one everyone wants to hear. This is a work of fiction. All characters and events are imagined. Nathan Brannick was not at his apartment. He was not answering his phone. His car, a 2014 Honda Civic with a cracked taillight and an expired inspection sticker, was not parked in his building's lot or on any of the surrounding streets. His neighbors hadn't seen him in days, which apparently wasn't unusual. The woman in 4C described him as the quiet one who plays sad music too loud, which Grimes supposed was as good an epitaph as any for a young man's 20s. "He's running," Callahan said. "He's gone," Grimes corrected. "Running implies he knows there's something to run from." She moved through the apartment with her hands in her pockets. Not a search, just a read. The sink held 3 days of dishes, maybe four. A coat hung on the hook by the door, still there, the kind of thing you take if you're planning to be gone for more than a day. A coffee mug sat on the counter with a ring of dried brown at the bottom. The couch cushions held the impression of someone who had been sleeping there and left without making it right. The window above the fire escape was unlocked, not because he'd used it, because he hadn't thought to lock it before he left. "Look at this place," Grimes said. "It looks like someone walked out in the middle of something." "Which is what people who run do." "No. This looks like he walked out for a gallon of milk and kept going." She turned back to the door. "Get the plates flagged. I want to know where that car goes." Callahan made a note. Grimes looked at the coat on the hook one more time, then left. The cab company record came back before lunch. A credit card pickup on the night of the murder, Nate's address on record, fare destination confirmed as the Meridian Hotel, time-stamped 9:47 p.m. Callahan set it on Grimes's desk without comment, which was his way of commenting. She read it twice. Nate had taken a cab to his father's hotel on the night his father was killed. He'd told no one about this. Not when he was arrested for public intox at 1:15 in the morning, not when the arresting officers had logged his name into the system, not in any of the hours between the arrest and his release at 7 in the morning. She didn't conclude anything. She wrote it down. Tom's phone records arrived that afternoon, expedited because a retired cop was dead and someone at the carrier had a conscience or a supervisor. Grimes spread the pages on her desk and went through them with a yellow pen. The call to Nate was there, 6:47 p.m., 4 minutes, the evening before check-in. It confirmed what Nate had told them. "I'm coming into town, we'll have dinner, my treat." The last call he ever made to his son. But there were others. 3 calls to a number that traced to a prepaid cell purchased with cash at a gas station on Route 6 in Whitfield County, 40 minutes east of Dunmore. No subscriber information. The buyer had paid cash for a phone that came with $17 of preloaded credit and left no name. The calls had gone out over 2 weeks, the last one 4 days before Tom checked into the Meridian. 2 of them had run for 8 minutes and 11 minutes. Whatever they'd talked about, it hadn't been brief. and then two calls to a landline in Whitfield. Grimes dialed it from her desk. A receptionist answered on the second ring. Hartley and Gorman, attorneys at law. Grimes identified herself. The receptionist's voice shifted in the particular way that voices do when a badge enters the conversation, cooperative in posture, guarded in detail. "Someone called your office recently from this number," Grimes said. "Thomas Brannick. I need to know who he spoke to and what about." "I'm sorry, detective, but any conversation with an attorney or about client matters would be privileged. I can confirm a call was received, but I can't share the content without a court order." "Thomas Brannick is dead. I don't think he can sue over a privilege disclosure. Can you tell me the general subject area, without names?" A pause. "I can say the inquiry was related to adoption records, private adoption specifically. That's all I can offer you without the subpoena." "Understood," Grimes said. "I'll be filing for one." She hung up and sat for a moment. Tom Brannick had been trying to reach someone who didn't want to be reached. A burner number, no subscriber, cash purchase. He'd also been calling lawyers about private adoption records. He'd been driving to the city. He'd been pulling old case files at the Dunmore station and not telling anyone why. "Something Claire left me." She wrote the phrase at the top of a clean page and underlined it. Callahan appeared at the corner of her desk. "DNA is submitted. Tub swabs, the remaining mirror shards, material from under the fingernails. Lab says 3 weeks minimum." "Did you tell them retired law enforcement?" "I told them. They bumped it up. 2 weeks, maybe less if we're lucky." He paused. "The scene was contaminated. Aoki isn't optimistic about the swabs from the main room. The housekeeper mopped, but the tub area held." Grimes nodded. The tub was the least contaminated part of the scene because Maria Gutierrez had found the body before she could finish. The one mercy in a contaminated scene was that the tub, where Tom had died, where he'd fought back, had not been mopped or bleached or tidied. Whatever was under those fingernails, the housekeeper hadn't gotten to it. She didn't hold any of this optimistically. She submitted the samples and waited. The bellhop was Devin Carter, 22, night shift, covering for a coworker whose illness was probably a hangover, but was officially food poisoning. Callahan had pulled Nate's booking photo from the public intoxication arrest, the bloodshot eyes, the stubbled jaw, the unfocused look of a man who had been drinking since early evening, and walked it through the hotel staff one by one. Devin was the one who stopped. He looked at the photo for a long moment, head slightly tilted, the way people do when they're trying to match something to a memory that isn't fully formed. "There was a guy," he said. "Came through the lobby maybe 9:30 that night. Didn't stop at the desk, went straight to the elevators like he knew where he was going." "Can you describe him?" "White guy, tallish, dark hair. He looked, I don't know, like he had somewhere to be and didn't want to talk about it." Callahan held the photo up again. "Is this the guy?" Devin squinted at it. "Could be. I didn't get a great look. He was moving fast. But the build is right. The hair, I'd say, yeah, could be him." "Could be" was not an identification. Grimes knew that. Devin Carter had seen a man in a hotel lobby moving fast at 9 o'clock at night and was now looking at a photo 2 weeks later under fluorescent lights. "Could be" meant the details were not wrong. It didn't mean the details were right. She wrote it down exactly as Devin had said it. In the car on the way back, Callahan was already talking about the hotel ID as if it were something harder. Grimes said nothing. She'd learned that the first thing people do with soft evidence is force it to a model they already have, squeeze out the qualifications until "could be" becomes "was" in the retelling. She wasn't going to do that. Not yet. On a Thursday, 5 days after the body was found, a state trooper in central Pennsylvania ran the plates on a 2014 Honda Civic doing 72 in a 65 on Route 15 North. The plates came back flagged. Grimes's phone rang 20 minutes later. She was already reaching for her car keys before the call ended. The state trooper's name was Voss. Nate would remember that later, Not because it mattered, but because the mind grabs onto small things when the big things are too heavy to hold. Voss. He'd been driving for most of the day. The rest stop off Route 15 was behind him, where he'd slept the night before, Claire's photograph on the dashboard, the seat reclined as far as it would go. He was heading back. Back to the apartment, or back to the city, or just back to somewhere that had walls and heat and a door he could close. Tom still hadn't called. That thought had stopped feeling like an annoyance 2 days ago, and had started feeling like something else. He wasn't going fast. The trooper's car in his mirror, the lights, the pull to the shoulder, none of it scared him. He'd been arrested before. Once. Public intox on a night he'd rather not think about, but they'd let him sleep it off and sent him home. He put his blinker on and pulled over and got out his registration.
Out of the vehicle, now!
He looked up. Voss was not standing where you stand for a routine traffic stop. He was standing wide, one hand near his belt, his body angled the way they teach in the academy when a stop has been flagged as potentially dangerous. A second trooper was already out of the cruiser, coming around the passenger side.
What's going on? Nate said. I wasn't going that fast.
Turn around, hands on the vehicle, now!
His hands went to the roof of the Civic, cold metal. Voss kicked his feet apart, not asked, kicked, and patted him down hard and fast, the way you'd search someone you already knew was trouble. The second trooper was on the radio, his voice low. Suspect located, Route 15 North, affirmative, in custody.
Suspect.
Am I under arrest? What is this about? Voss didn't answer. He pulled Nate's wrists behind his back. The cuffs went on tight, two clicks past necessary, the metal biting directly into bone rather than riding against it. Nate made a sound, involuntary, and tried to shift his hands.
Stop resisting.
I'm not. The cuffs are cutting into me.
I said stop resisting.
The second trooper had come around the car. He was younger than Voss, holding himself with the rigid posture of someone who'd been told this stop was dangerous and believed it. His hand was still on his weapon.
Can someone tell me what's happening?
We're transporting you to the barracks, Voss said. Detectives from the city want to talk to you.
About what?
Voss looked at him, a flat, appraising look. The look you give something you've been warned about, something you've been told might be exactly as dangerous as the alert on your screen suggested.
I think you know what this is about.
I don't. I honestly don't know.
Save it for the detectives.
Voss had a hand on the back of Nate's neck and was walking him toward the cruiser. Nate's foot caught on the gravel shoulder. He went forward. Voss's hand tightened. The second trooper was already moving, fast, the way someone moves when they've been on edge since the call came through and have been waiting for exactly this moment. Nate felt himself turned, driven down, his face meeting the asphalt with a sound that was less impact than surrender. A knee settled onto his back, gravel against his cheek. The sky, visible in a narrow strip above the tree line, was a pale and indifferent blue. His elbow had caught something on the way down, the second trooper's jaw, probably, the involuntary flail of a body losing its balance with its hands cuffed behind its back. The report would say what the report would say.
Suspect resisting,
Voss said into his radio, his voice measured and professional above the knee pressing the air out of Nate's chest.
Additional charges, assault on an officer.
They put him in the back of the cruiser. Nobody spoke. Nate sat with his face throbbing and his wrists aching and tried to understand what was happening, and the silence from the front seat offered nothing except the sound of the radio and the sound of the road. At the state police barracks, they walked him through a side entrance. Two troopers he hadn't seen before were waiting in the corridor. One of them, older, thick through the shoulders, the kind of cop who wore his badge the way some men wear their father's watch, stepped aside to let them pass and didn't step far enough. His shoulder caught Nate square in the chest, a deliberate collision dressed as carelessness. Nate went sideways into the cinder block wall. The older trooper didn't apologize, didn't look back. Voss's grip on Nate's arm tightened, but he said nothing either. The booking room was fluorescent and without mercy.
They photographed him, swollen left eye, split lip, bruised wrists where the cuffs had bitten, scraped knuckles from the asphalt, a welt on his cheekbone already going the color of a storm. The photographer did not comment on the injuries. Nobody commented on the injuries. They emptied his pockets into a tray. Wallet, keys, $11 in change, and when his jacket came off, the photograph came with it. Claire, holding him as a baby. Both of them squinting against the sun, her face radiant with the particular joy of a woman holding exactly what she wanted most. The photograph went into the inventory bag with everything else. Nate watched it disappear behind the clear plastic, and then he was looking at the wall, and the wall had nothing to tell him. They chained him to the table in the interview room and left. The interview room was small and smelled like burned coffee and tired air. The table was laminate. The clock on the wall had a second hand that moved in small, stuttering jerks, like it was counting out something that kept almost stopping. Nate had been in the room for what felt like 6 hours when the door opened. He would learn later it had been four. Two people came in, a woman and a man. She led, he followed and took a position slightly behind her left shoulder, pen and notepad already in hand. She looked at him across the table and he looked back at her, and in that first exchange, nothing passed between them that he could name. "Nobody's told me anything," Nate said. His voice came out rough. "They pulled me over, cuffed me, drove me here. That was hours ago. Nobody has said a word about why I'm in chains." "Nathan," the woman's voice was even. "I'm Detective Grimes. This is Detective Callahan. We're from the city." "What city? What is this?" He leaned forward, the chains going taut. "Can you just tell me what's happening? Is this about the arrest? The public intox? I already—" "Nathan." She let the word settle. "When was the last time you spoke to your father?" The question landed wrong. He couldn't say why exactly, just that it was not the question he'd expected, and that it arrived with a particular weight that questions about his own arrest didn't have. "A few days ago, he called, said he was coming to the city, said we'd have dinner." He looked at her face and found nothing in it. "Is he okay? Did something happen to him?" She didn't answer immediately. She watched him across the table with the same quiet attention she'd had since she walked through the door. Not hostile, not warm, just watching. "Nathan, your father was found dead in a hotel room in the city. Room 1412, the Meridian Hotel. He was killed." The word killed arrived differently than dead. He heard both of them, but the second one took a moment to land. The sound that came out of him was small. Not a sob, something that preceded a sob, the intake of breath before the collapse. His whole body changed at once, shoulders dropping, head coming forward, and his hands came up instinctively and stopped 6 inches from his face, the chains pulling taut. "Killed," he said. The word came out hollow. "What do you mean, how—" "He was beaten to death, Nathan." He sat with it. The chains clinked softly as his hands shook. He could hear the clock on the wall, the stuttering second hand. He could hear the detective's partner writing something on his notepad, the scratch of a pen moving across paper. He could hear the fluorescent light above him, the faint electrical hum of it, the way it turned everything a flat and colorless white. His father was dead. Tom had driven to the city and checked into a hotel, and someone had beaten him to death. Tom had called him 3 days ago and said, "We'll have dinner, my treat." And now he was dead, and Nate was chained to a table in a state police barracks in Pennsylvania, and the detective sitting across from him was watching his face with the same even attention she'd had from the moment she walked in. "I need to know where you were," Grimes said, "the night your father checked in." He pulled himself back. The grief was there, enormous and waiting, and he pushed it to one side because she was asking him something and he had to answer. "I was at my apartment. Then I went out. McCaffrey's. It's a bar on 9th. He paused. "I got arrested. Public intox. You probably know about that." "We do. That's 1:15 a.m. What happened before that?" Something shifted in his chest. Not quite recognition, closer to a feeling of standing on ice that has just cracked somewhere nearby. I was at my apartment, then I went out. Did you receive a text message from your father's phone that evening? He stopped. The chains went still. The question had arrived too specifically, the way questions do when someone already knows the answer.
Yeah, he said. It said he was at the Meridian, just the name of the hotel. I didn't know what to do with it. He'd been dodging me for weeks, and then this two-word text, like I was supposed to know what it meant.
What did you do? He heard himself say it before he thought about how it would sound.
I took a cab there.
The detective's partner stopped writing. Grimes's face didn't change. The ice cracked a little further. I was already drinking. I was angry at him. He'd been pulling away ever since my mom died. And I wanted to see him, or I wanted to yell at him, I don't know, both. He stopped. I went to the building. I stood outside. I didn't go in.
You stood outside the hotel where your father was murdered, on the night he was murdered.
I was too drunk to trust myself. We would have fought, a real fight, not the silent kind, and I didn't want that. So I left. He heard how every word of this sounded. He heard the shape of it. I went to a bar called the Lamplighter, two blocks over. Two drinks, then McCaffrey's. Then I was sitting on the curb and a cop woke me up.
Anyone who can confirm you were at the Lamplighter?
Maybe the bartender. I paid cash. I didn't talk to anyone. She wrote something down. He watched her write it and felt the ice beneath him and couldn't see where the edge was. He told her about the distance between him and Tom since Claire died. The unreturned calls, the deflections, the sense that Tom was chasing something he wouldn't name. He told her because she asked, and because it was the truth, and because the truth was the only thing he had. She listened without expression. Her partner wrote everything down and stopped writing when certain things were said and started again, and Nate noticed the pattern without being able to read it.
You were angry at him, Grimes said.
I was worried about him, both.
Those aren't mutually exclusive.
He stared at her. The swollen eye made it look like a squint, like he was trying to see something through a window too far away. You think I did this?
She didn't answer. The silence did the work instead.
He sat in it and felt the full weight of where he was, the chains on his wrists, the borrowed light overhead, the clock with its stuttering second hand, and understood for the first time that the two people across this table were not here to help him understand what happened to his father. They were here because of what they thought he had done to his father. He looked down at his hands, the scraped knuckles, the bruised wrists, the gap in the evening where the bars had blurred together and he had drunk himself into a curbside arrest, hours he could not fully account for, time that existed in his memory only as fragments.
I didn't do it, he said.
His voice caught on something. The chains clinked as his hands moved. I don't think I... He heard himself. He heard what it sounded like. He looked at his knuckles and the question came out of him before he could stop it. I didn't do it, right? Almost to himself. Almost a prayer. Grimes closed her notebook. We'll be in touch, Nathan. Don't go anywhere. She and Callahan left. The door closed. The clock counted its jerky seconds into the silence, and Nate sat with the chains and the light and the things she hadn't answered, and the grief that had been waiting folded over him all at once. Later, after he'd been moved to a holding cell, Nate lay on the narrow cot and looked at the ceiling and thought about the inventory bag. Claire's photograph, behind clear plastic, in a bag with his wallet and his keys and $11. She was holding him as a baby, both of them squinting against the sun, her face entirely given over to it. Happiness he'd never thought twice about, because why would you? He hadn't meant to take it from Tom's house. He'd been standing in the attic surrounded by the excavated contents of his childhood. Boxes pulled down from the rafters, papers spread across the floor, things he didn't understand and was too tired and too angry to try to understand. And the photograph was in a box, and he'd put it in his jacket pocket without deciding to. A reflex. The thing your hand reaches for when everything else has become incomprehensible. His father was dead. The detectives from the city thought he had done it. and the only thing he had, the one piece of anything, was behind plastic in an evidence bag, waiting to be returned to him when someone decided he was entitled to his own belongings again. Was I happy? The question arrived without warning, without a clear answer. He didn't know when it had become the most important question there was.